What if we created a system that they call Aeneas to go and scan the historical record to surface interesting parallels for people to look into?
If the cost goes down, I think we will see an explosion of knowledge.
It wasn't trying to do the same job that the human would have been doing.
Some of the things that I know the study showed, they were physically impossible to do.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a group of brilliant minds to explain, distill, and hot take our way through the truly bewildering wave of news each week in artificial intelligence. Today, I'm joined by a stellar veteran crew. We've got Kush Varshney, IBM Fellow AI Governance, Volkmar Ulig, VP AI Infrastructure Portfolio Lead, and Kautar El-Megrawi, Principal Research Scientist and Manager for the Hybrid Cloud Platform. We have a packed episode today. We're going to talk about agents, of course. We're going to talk about using AI for ancient history, and we have a special segment with Suja Viswesan on the latest cost of a data breach report. But first, I want to talk about study mode. All right, so just to quickly introduce this topic, ChatGPT announced a new feature just this past week called ChatGPT Study Mode. And basically what it is a feature where you click it and it's sort of an interactive learning experience. It asks questions, it sort of challenges you. And I wanted to bring it up because if you recall, listeners of the show will recall a few months ago, I think, we covered this report out of the MIT Media Lab that scanned people's brains. And it kind of took over at least my social media because it was all about how, you know, ChatGPT is making us stupid, right? Like if you literally use AI to write essays, your brain is firing less. And I think this is sort of a really funny and interesting story, in part because this is like an explicit attempt by ChatGPT to not have that happen. But I just first want to do maybe a quick round the horn question like usual. And that round the horn question is, I'm curious about your favorite study method. Do you use flashcards, outlines, practice tests? Maybe Kush, I'll start with you if you've got a preferred study method.
Yeah, I just read the book. I think that's the the easiest.
That's great. Kautar, what's your method?
I usually use active recall. You know, I read and try to close and try to repeat to myself.
That's a good one. I usually use that one as well. And Volkmar, how about you?
I'm on Kush's side. I'm just reading the book.
Just reading the book.
Luckily, I don't need to remember things anymore that are relevant.
Yeah, so, exactly. I had to kind of think back for this question. I was like, standardized tests. How did I go about doing that? And yeah, I think active recall was what I tried to do. All right. Well, so what I want to do is kind of talk a little bit about this idea, because I think it's so interesting because, you know, I think people are always like, oh, AI is making us dumb. AI is making us smart. But like, I think so much of this is like how you actually design the systems. And so, Kush, I'm curious, have you had a chance to play around a little bit with study mode?
Not yet. But this isn't exactly new, I would say, because Claude had their sort of learning mode come out in April. And other people have been kind of playing around with this. So, I think it's a good thing to have this like other kind of role that the LLM is taking, because, I mean, a content generator isn't the only thing. An assistant isn't the only thing. You can think about a muse, an editor, a devil's advocate. I mean, all sorts of different roles that an LLM is going to want to take. And it's not going to happen naturally because of all of the RLHF that's been done on these things. Having these additional roles is a very good thing.
Volkmar, I'm curious, you know, so I was talking to a friend about all this, and, you know, he was basically like a cynic about this whole feature. He was like, look, people just want the answer. No one's really going to use study mode. This is just kind of like a marketing thing they're using to kind of like push back against the narrative that AIs are making us dumb. Do you buy that argument? I don't know if you're a cynic like he is.
No, I have two kids. So
yeah.
I think it's actually great because I think the people learn differently. Some people just need, you know, YouTube videos. Others want frontal teaching. Other people want to be quizzed. And so I think it's just in the repertoire. It's almost a tutor, someone who watches you, you know, and then if you don't, or if you make mistakes, then, you know, the system would actually adapt to your behavior. And so it's almost like Khan Academy, pushed into an LLM. So I think it's a great extension to, you know, the portfolio. So if you give kids the answer, they will not learn. And I think that quizzing method is actually pretty good.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, Volkmar, you mentioned Khan Academy. I think this is like where I want to go with this discussion, because I think, you know, we can debate the feature and how effective it is and what it's useful for. But I mean, Kaoto, there's been a lot of discussion, at least among kind of my circles, about how far all of this AI stuff goes in terms of education. And, you know, I feel like these types of features kind of point the way to the idea of like, well, how much learning is just eventually going to be like completely doable through AI, right? Like, and which raises really big questions about kind of traditional schooling. I know you always hesitate to do like, you know, grand forecasts, but where do you think this stuff goes in a few years? I mean, do we feel like we're going to eventually have a technology which is kind of competitive to, I don't know, what you might get from a traditional education?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. It seems to me that, you know, already right now, many, you know, teachers and students are already using AI. So I think whether we want it or not. And so I think this new mode that they have, I feel it's similar to like a cognitive gym. So because this study mode, it's kind of a step towards a design philosophy that could be kind of a gym versus like a crutch. Because right now, typically how students or how many people use, you know, the LLMs is as a cognitive crutch. So it does the work for you to make your life easier. But the idea of this cognitive gym is basically it's designed to make you do the work, but with some expert guidance and support and kind of make you stronger in the process. So I feel like the future of truly valuable AI in education and professional development isn't about providing answers faster, but it's about building those systems that are experts, Socratic partners that should know when to give you the hint, when to ask a probing question, and when to force you to struggle a bit. So it definitely, if this is done right, it's going to be a huge kind of way to redesign the whole educational system. But I think this whole idea of the tutor, it's a much harder design challenge than just building a better answer engine. So how do we really shift, you know, the metrics from time to answer to depth of user understanding? How do you evaluate these systems? And so it's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's worth getting into. I mean, the ethics of this and how you go about doing it, I think, are pretty interesting. I guess at least from what OpenAI said in their blog post, they said, you know, we consulted with all these expert educators and we kind of have some magic working in the background to like make sort of study mode work. I guess to Volkmar's point, Kush, I don't know if you have an opinion on this. Like, ideally, you would eventually want AI to be able to kind of just like go multimodal for whatever teaching method it thinks is going to be the most effective, right? I don't know if you think we can get there, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing, I mean, what Volkmar brought up, what Kautar is bringing up as well is like just having a little bit more kind of control over this, right? So you don't want the AI to have the agency because there's a finite amount. Like the AI can have some agency, the human can have some agency. And you just need to balance it. So it's not just doing everything for you. It's not taking control over the entire sort of situation. And I mean, the next topic we'll get to is kind of along the same lines. It's like, how do we kind of have these things adapt to us, make sure that it's doing things in the ways that that make sense for us. And yeah, I just wanted to bring up one article that actually came out yesterday. It's in this maybe lesser known sort of news outlet called Rest of World. So it's about kind of technology in the rest of the world. And it goes through and talks about, I mean, how like teaching is happening in like rural Colombia. And it's making the point that, yeah, I mean, let's say OpenAI or Anthropic are doing these things, but those are like closed proprietary sort of things. And in these schools in rural Colombia, people are using the AI that's integrated with WhatsApp. It's just like the level of reading has gone down in a year, like all these sort of things. So it's great that, I mean, we're seeing this, but how are we going to bring it down to a broader population? Because just keeping it enclosed within a ChatGPT is not going to be the thing for most of us.
Yeah, I think it's a really hard problem there. Volkmar, before we move to the next topic, I don't know if you want to offer some parenting advice. So I've got a few kids at home. And I think we've been traditionally quite cynical about any screen time whatsoever, right? So we've been like very much like keep them away from the screens. But they're kind of reaching an age where I'm like, should I give them access to like chatbots? Like, so I don't know how you approach that with your kids. Like, yeah. For our listeners, would you recommend?
Yeah, my kids are a bit older. They're teenagers. You know, the screen, that train left the station like a couple of years back.
Long, long time ago.
So what I'm seeing is in the education system is that if you look at a traditional public school system, there is effectively a fight against AI, which is primarily because I think the public education system is not willing to adjust the curriculum. We are looking across the board, and we are also looking at, for example, schools which it's completely integrated AI into the curriculum. So there are, I'm in Austin, there are a couple of schools here which said, you know, you do studying for 2 hours, solely AI based, no teacher. And then everything else is project work, where, you know, kids are doing crazy stuff. Like there's a kid which built a BMX bike park in the city of Austin. Needs to raise funding, build it, et cetera, right? So I think we are at the point where we finally have the opportunity to explore new education methods. I think that's the primary thing. You know, because so far for hundreds of years, it has been teachers standing in the front and a bunch of kids need to listen. And suddenly we can actually adjust it and adjust it also to the learning speed of the kids. And I think this is, my kids are really bored in school. And so, you know, they're kind of sitting and waiting until the class catches up. And I think with AI, we suddenly have the ability to either go deeper or to, you know, just let them sprint ahead. And I think, you know, you will, at the edges of the bell curve, you will just get so much more happiness.
I think if I might add to this, Tim, I also have kids that range from like teenagers to 9-year-old and 16 and college. Yeah. So it's important, I think, to introduce the right tools at the right age. So like for maybe kids 1 to 6, kid-friendly tools like Khan Academy Kids or something like that. But middle school and high school, you know, things like, you know, Quizlet AI or AI Tutor, where it's more like an interactive, not just a passive learning. So you promote active learning where you teach the children how to interact with the AI, ask follow-up questions, learn how to prompt things, you know, more in intelligent manner. And then, but also give them times when there is no screen time. So I think it should be a combination of, you know, no AI. So they you force, you know, their cognitive capabilities to build, but also slowly introduce the AI because that's going to be their war. They're going to be using these things whether we want it or not. So they need to learn how to use it ethically in safe ways and more, you know, in a interactive, not a passive manner.
This goes along what came out yesterday that Meta is changing the interviewing process. And so they actually ask people who interview that they can actively use AI tools to solve the interview questions, right? And so I think it shows the shift from, you know, are you individually capable of actually solving the problem, or are you able to use tools to solve the problem? And so I think we are outside of the realm where, you know, you don't use AI. The expectation is you do. And so we need to test whether you are, you know, correctly using the tools, not if you are able to solve the problem without the tool.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's all these kind of interesting like processes and systems in society that kind of assume no AI. And it's very interesting, like everybody's like, either it's like fight or adapt. And I think eventually everybody will have to adapt, but it's kind of like how long they want to sort of put this off and what pain they're willing to go through for that. That's really interesting. I hadn't heard that Meta was doing it. Kush, any final thoughts on this topic before we move on?
We just need this to be more inclusive. I mean, because the best and the brightest are going to like have these sort of things at their hands, but how do we make sure that that everyone does? We don't want this just to be a luxury good.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, I'm going to move us on to our next topic. This is a submission from Volkmar, so I'll tee it up to you as the first commenter on it. Interesting tweet came out from a gentleman by the name of Greg Eisenberg. He's an entrepreneur, runs a few companies, and it's kind of a very nice little sort of Twitter or now X essay. And he kind of starts it by saying there's a quiet shift happening in how we design software. We're moving from UX to AX, agentic experience, is what he says. And originally I was like, another agent thing. I don't want to look at it. But then the more I read, the more interesting it became. And I think I'll just kind of quickly sort of sum it up. I think his argument was, you know, back in the old days, we would design applications, interfaces with sort of this idea that like the flow of that interface was fixed, Right. And essentially that the interface was dumb. You would start from zero and then you'd maybe do a little bit of customization, but a lot of it would be like, how do you guide the user through kind of this like very uniform sort of experience of an application or a website. And so his kind of argument is, well, with agents now, we're living in a world where these interfaces can become a lot more intelligent. They can be retain a lot more information about how we interact with it. They can retain a lot more information in terms of like what we do or have done on that site. And so I think his vision is a future where these interfaces become a lot more malleable, a lot more adaptable. And that really kind of changing the way we've traditionally done UX, which is to think about these very sort of fixed flows. And so I guess, Volkmar, you submitted this one. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about why you thought this was interesting and where you think, you know, our listeners should focus on here.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the core change here is to rethink how we are interfacing with the machine. And, you know, as you just pointed out, this was the work of a designer. And the designer had to kind of figure out what are the most common flows. And I think AI is really interesting in two ways. So one is, usually you implement 90% of the flows and 10% is exception handling. And so if you look from an enterprise perspective, the 10% is your labor cost, right? Because you have all these people sitting around which are dealing with the cases which haven't been implemented. And so now you suddenly can go and say, well, I'm fundamentally changing the interface. It's dialogue-based, or even, you know, even if it is an application where you interact with the screen, the screen elements could be generated directly by AI, and you know, you have an adaptive user interface because kind of the AI thinks ahead what's the next step, and it gives you the choices, and maybe you don't want to type, you know, my next choice is this, but maybe you have a bunch of icons you click on also. The other thing is, if the user interface goes away from pre-programmed flows, the speed of new user interfaces will be incredible, because now you just describe what your fundamental business problem is you're trying to solve, or, you know, consumer problem, and then the AI can just fill in the gap. So I think now on the flip side, the implication is, how do you prompt? Because the AI could get lost in the weeds, right? So I think it will be a new skill set. How do I put, you know, guardrails around a model and the possible questions and answers it gives? What I can't wait for is that I don't need to re-enter my name and my credit card and my billing address, because there is absolutely no reason that I need to do this every single time. So the system can incorporate, you know, information it already collected about us. And that's kind of like, you know, when you go to the bakery on the corner and they know already what you want. And so I think that's something we now can actually create in the digital realm. And it's, you know, I think so user interfaces will become much more personal, which is nice. You know, it's adapted to you and not to the mass.
Yeah, I think this world starts to look very interesting and different. I was reminded of recently my wife was in the other room and she said, oh, could you pick up my phone and I need to text a friend? And I picked it up and I was like, this home screen makes absolutely no sense to me. It's like all the apps are in different places, lots of different kinds of configuration. I think one really interesting world is that in the future, you might sit down at like someone else's computer and just realize that like, wait, this is, what even application am I using here? Because like, it would be so customized to their use. I don't know, Kautar, if you had kind of responses to this, if you're excited about this world of customization, or if you have, at least in my case, like a little bit of hesitance that it might actually be really baffling, I think, because everything's going to be very customized in a way that at least I didn't grow up with, right?
Yeah, I think I have mixed feelings here. So I think, you know, part of me is like, this is going to be exciting, like this super customization that's going to make life easier. And, you know, I talk to, you know, these agents and they know me so well. So I don't have to explain myself every time, like Volkmar said, you know, re-enter all my history. So they know everything I want. But then, at this, you know, the flip side of things, is that too bad? You know, when they know too much, you know, what's the implication? What's the security implications? Like you're saying here, when we interact with others or when we try to, you know, look at other people's, you know, phones or experiences, we're going to be lost. So it's like your world is going to be super customized that you're going to be lost, you know, in other words. But I see, you know, this is a big shift that we're noticing. So this move from UX to AX, it is one of the profound shifts in human-computer interactions, you know, since I think the graphical user interface. So it seems to me we're moving in from a world where operators, where we are operators of tools, to where we are managers of agents. And so it's not about, you know, having like these menus and buttons and so on. It's more about having these conversations. And it's you know for decades we had, you know, this invisible UI that was so intuitive, the user didn't have to think. But in the agentic world, I think it's the opposite. The agent's reasoning must be really transparent. You know, like if I'm asking an agent to spend about, you know, thousands of dollars of my money, I don't want magic here. I really want a clear plan and the ability to approve it and the trust. So the core design challenge here, I think, is moving from, you know, how do I arrange pixels on a screen to more about how do I design a relationship between the human and the agent, and a relationship that is built on trust, which requires, you know, several things like competence. Does it do the job well? Transparency. Can I understand what it's doing and control? Can I intervene and correct, you know, when things are going wrong? And so that is a big shift that we're noticing right now in human-computer interaction.
Kautar summarized it quite well. I mean, this is a new paradigm of interaction. And something that my team has been pursuing quite a bit recently is this concept of mutual theory of mind. Pretty much what we've already heard, right? When two people are interacting, if I know what the other person is thinking and they know what I'm thinking, we can just work better together. And this goes to like second and third and fourth orders. So some of you might have seen this movie a long time ago, The Princess Bride, and there's a whole scene about like this guy thinking of what the other person is thinking and back and forth. This is exactly a way to make things more productive in a relational sort of way. And I think there's going to be all these like things from human relationships that are going to come into it. So it's not just going to be the AI that adjusts to us, but us adjusting to the AI. We're going to be introducing ourselves to AIs. AIs are going to be introducing themselves to us. There's going to be just thinking that what's the level of conversation that I should be having? Are there particular information processing styles that I should be appealing to, like in both directions? And I think that's going to be like such a nice sort of change for us. It'll allow so much more tinkerability that we can make these things authentic for what we need. But yeah, the risks are there, as Kautar talked about, as Volkmar talked about as well. So yeah, just balancing all of that.
Yeah, for sure. There's one hypothesis that I had kind of thinking through this post that I thought was fun, because we can almost draw an analogy to, you know, the rhetoric of like the 2000s was like, oh, we're going to about to be live in a world where, you know, everybody can have a blog. There's going to be blogs on every possible topic you could think of. And, you know, at the time it was called like the long tail, right? Like, oh, well, you know, the most popular shows will become less popular, and then there'll be lots and lots of kind of like micro shows everywhere. And I think one reflection from that era was, well, that didn't actually quite happen. Like, it turns out that like on YouTube, there's actually still a small group that gets like this huge amount of attention, because it turns out that like people have kind of some shared things that they're interested in. And there is usually like breakout, you know, behaviors. And I guess I'm curious if, Volkmar, you think that's maybe one outcome for all this, which is that you set up all this agentic tooling on your interfaces. You allow the interfaces to like drift and customize every way you want. But it turns out that like humans are very similar. And so you actually end up with like a lot of interfaces that are really quite similar for the vast majority of users. And then there's like this very long, long tail of like truly bizarre interfaces. Yeah. Do you think that's like maybe one outcome that we end up with?
If you look at the web, right, the web, there was tons of different versions, and now it's all standardized. It all looks the same. And it's primarily that you can go from one web page to another, and your cognitive load to go from one to the other is low. Right? And so I think we will have some of them which will, you know, become more dominant, and then everybody just will follow. But I think this is exactly where we need to go through an experimentation phase, which is why I'm really excited about this. It's like, finally, after 40 years, it's not a mouse and, you know, an input field, but we can actually rethink a user experience. And that wasn't, I mean, the last major shift in user experience was the iPhone, you know, and where the input device changed from a mouse to a finger. But otherwise, I mean, not much has happened. And so I think, you know, and this morning I drove in and, you know, Tesla now has Grok in the car. And so I actually use it quite often. I used to use it on my phone. You just have conversations and, you know, I'm like, okay, you know, I found this paper. Can you summarize it for me? So I'm actually having a dialogue with the car now, which is kind of silly, but it's like, you know, it's 25 minutes driving. So I can actually do stuff while driving, right? And so I think we will get into user interfaces where there is an expectation how a flow looks like. If you book an airline ticket, if you buy something, but you may branch off, but it knows stuff about you. And so I think it will cut out steps you don't want, but I think there will a new way of actually interfacing with the machine will emerge. And I think we are currently in the experimentation phase, but it's nice that there's actually something new.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's a breath of fresh air. I met someone recently who is the person who allegedly influenced the interface where you pull and then it refreshes on your phone. She was like, yep, that was me. And I was like, that's really crazy that we kind of obviously had someone had to come up with that. And it's interesting to think that we're like in a very similar place for AI now where all of those kind of like sort of tropes or design patterns need to be built out.
Yeah, I think what also excites me a lot is those neuromorphic interfaces, like where your brain is actually interfacing or your eye or so, not just your voice. So other things, you know, that will be used as part of these brain-computer interfaces or these prosthetics and biofeedback devices. And there's a whole world of these new things that will emerge, some of them might be very useful, especially for people with disabilities. I hope, you know, that's going to open up a lot of things that they can't do today. So that is really exciting.
Yeah, I was just reading a paper yesterday. It was from some folks from Korea. And they're kind of thinking about what the next sort of iteration of interaction research is. And like kind of going and expanding, like we've kind of gotten to a point where we have a definition of human-centered AI, but the next thing is maybe like group-centered AI, because you can kind of rely on like cognitive psychology and these sort of things at the individual level. But now you're going to have these things in teams, human and AI mixed sort of teams. And really, it's a social psychology sort of question now. And really, like, what are the new considerations? How do you like make sure that everyone's voice is heard? Like all of these sort of things are going to be part of it. So I think that's another angle for at least exciting research to come.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and I think I was just thinking when Volkmar was talking earlier, there's kind of a funny world where everybody has their own different interface in the future because we can do that now. But agents still need to talk to agents. And so like MCP will be like the standard. So like the remaining standardized part of the web will be only what agents can see. And everything else will be very customized when it's like, you know, getting to a human readable state. And I think the complexity of that will be like very interesting to navigate. All right, so I'm going to move us on to our last topic. Super fun paper came out. If you're like me and enjoy reading papers in Nature, this is one for you. It's called Contextualizing Ancient Texts with Generative Neural Networks. And it's a fun paper which basically says, look, a lot of the work of historians, particularly when they analyze ancient texts, is they look for what's known as parallels, right? They're looking for texts that have shared phrasing, or they have very shared function, or they have shared cultural settings. And the idea is you do research by putting these next to one another and trying to make inferences between them, right? Well, this was written in this place at this time, and this was written in this place at this time, but they share these commonalities. And we can say, hey, they, you know, maybe had a trade relationship, so their languages are similar and have some relation to one another. And so this group of researchers said, well, what, you know, pattern matching, looking for parallels is something that generative AI seems to do really, really well. So what if we created a system that they call Aeneas to go and scan the historical record to surface interesting parallels for people to look into? And the results are pretty interesting, right? So out of the candidate kind of parallels that were identified, they found that sort of historians found that these were like useful research starting points, in 90% of the cases of what Aeneas was sort of surfacing. And so I think this is a really fun story, and I think, Kautar, I'll throw it to you, you know, because I think normally we say, well, okay, there's AI in the commercial space. What's happening in B2B? What's happening in B2C? We also say, oh, okay, but also AI is really going to be good for research, right? And when we say research, we usually mean like pharma or math or all the other topics that we've talked about. But this is an application of generative AI to like a pretty different domain of research. And the results here seem pretty impressive.
Yeah, I really love, you know, this this direction here. And because I feel like we're in a world saturated with conversations about AI for profit, productivity, or power. So this is a story about AI for posterity here. So I think AI in its absolute best, not just replacing human labor, but even recovering like lost human thought. So I think this project is very kind of a powerful counter narrative, you know, to all these fears surrounding AI. It really shows that AI can be a tool for connection, not just for optimizations. It really connects us to, you know, the philosophers, you know, voice from like thousands of years ago, you know, voices that we thought were permanently, you know, silenced or lost. And, you know, I think it also provides kind of a blueprint here for the future of the humanities, you know. So the combination of advanced imaging, pattern recognition, you know, so here AI is creating a new field of kind of digital archaeology where we can apply the same techniques, you know, to faded manuscripts, damaged artworks, etc. But one of the key things, I think one of the questions that we need to pose here is how do we ensure that this incredibly powerful or often expensive AI tools are made accessible to researchers in the humanities? You know, they're often, I think, less funded departments. And this, you know, can unlock a lot of, you know, historical or cultural mysteries that could be kind of the next challenge for AI.
Volkmar, one of the things I was thinking a little bit about is, and I guess to Kautar's point about accessibility, but also kind of like the technology as a whole, like you imagine like the landscape of all the possible research problems humanity could work on. And you're like, okay, now I'm going to apply AI to them. And I guess we've often been assuming, or the discussion has often been assumed, like, oh, well, it's going to accelerate the hard sciences first, right? Like we're going to, material science is really going to accelerate very quickly, or finding new proteins is going to accelerate really quickly. But it may also just be that like this is kind of like a fundamentally lumpy thing. Like I imagine a world where like this parallels task is like something that like AI has been able to do for some time. There's almost a world where like even before we get like our future, even before we get all of the like, you know, super, super accelerated science, we actually might like have like this explosion in historical knowledge first. Like, I guess what I'm trying to point out is like AI is going to have all these weird effects on like what parts of our knowledge become like move quicker than others. Right. And I don't know. I think those outcomes are like very interesting to me.
Yeah, I agree. I think like we are touching or we're scraping right now on AGI. In the end, right, if you look at this, you can go and just let this thing run for a while and, you know, dig around and form hypotheses, and then based on those hypotheses, form further hypotheses, right? And this is really where I think that machines, because, you know, we have so many humans who are in archaeology, and, you know, as Kautar just said, you know, there's a limited funding in those areas, but suddenly you can fund this with just energy, right? And so at the moment, it's just energy and a bunch of GPUs. Like we can accelerate our knowledge about historic things just by a few people can actually make massive discoveries because, you know, they have suddenly a huge body of, I mean, in this case, NVIDIA chips behind them. And so suddenly you can actually get to new knowledge, which then will, you know, there's always this chain of thought. And so the moment you have something new invented, then, you know, what follows next? And I think here's now suddenly the possibility to go and explore crazy ideas, which we have not been willing to fund because, you know, you need to go and apply for grants and blah, blah, blah. And so suddenly I think it will open up a lot of understanding of the past. And also in just domains where we are traditionally not considering it as valuable. But if the cost goes down, I think we will see an explosion of knowledge.
Yeah, that's super interesting. It's kind of like the, Volkmar, it sounds like you're sort of arguing that there's this sort of like, there's this cognitive dividend basically that like applies to these fields, because usually it'd be really hard to get the grant funding to do this and have people put a huge amount of money into it. But like, I guess it feels like in a world of open source or even with like less sophisticated models, you might be able to get very, very far. And so there's like this benefit to all these fields that might not otherwise get funding to really push that research ahead.
You can do the same thing. I mean, what we are seeing in code generation, right? So you get a 10 to 1 ratio now. I can have one good engineer who can actually use a large language model and produce the code of 10 people. Why is that true in coding and not for all the other disciplines? Coding, I think, is just a very profitable business. And so that's where it gets applied first, because there's high competition for that skill set. But I mean, of course, it will be deployed in every skill set. And so I think we will get similar productivity gains. That it's just like, you know, people who are building models are programmers, and so they are making their tools first. But of course, it will roll into the other disciplines.
Yeah, for sure. Chris, I'll ask the obvious question, right? I guess some people listening to this will say, all of the archaeologists are out of a job. Mm-hmm. All the ancient historians are out of a job.
Yeah.
Do you buy that?
Yeah, I don't think so. And I mean, the fact that there was synergy shown in this particular paper is actually unique. I mean, like 95% of when there's human AI teams, you actually don't get any like overall benefit from the combination. And so here, because the task itself was the contextualization, it wasn't trying to do the same job that the human would have been doing, but freeing them up to do other sort of things as part of their workflow. I think that's the part of the story here. And the other thing that's interesting about this one is that Latin, which is what this is all about, has a lot of resources. There's been human historians, human archaeologists who have been studying this for a very long time. So there was a large corpus they could draw on. But when you look at lower-resourced ancient languages, so a great example is the Indus Valley Civilization, and their script is still undeciphered. And because there's such a paucity of content from that, so actually just earlier this year, there's a $1 million prize that was announced saying, can you use AI to decipher this Indus Valley Civilization script? And that's going to be a completely different sort of endeavor, because it's not kind of using all of the human sort of accumulation that that we have to do these things, but like, discover something completely new, completely different.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess it goes to, right, I think that's an important subtlety that I think Volkmar's comment earlier, and Chris, I think you're picking up on, right, is I guess we almost have to think about like where the bottlenecks are in the research. And here, I mean, a lot of it is just like you don't have enough like grad student bodies to throw at the data set to try to find these parallels. And so you're kind of like unlocking all of these opportunities just by like, you know, kind of effectively enhancing that labor or substituting that labor. So,
but I think additionally, you know, some of the things that, you know, the study showed, they were physically impossible to do. For example, these scrolls, they were buried and, you know, they were carbonized into these fragile solid lumps. Physically unrolling them would destroy them. So for centuries, you know, the content was a mystery. But right now, with the technology that involves, you know, doing the 3D scanning, you need using these high resolution CT scans to create, you know, the detailed 3D maps, and then using AI to train a computer vision model to detect, you know, these subtle differences, you know, on the density, the texture that correspond to these ancient ink. And doing the virtual unrolling. So the software can then unroll these detected ink patterns. So these things, you know, physically it was not possible to be done by, you know, researchers or humans. So the AI here is unlocking, you know, these things that are, you know, great things. Researchers, you know, having a, you know, able to read entire passages, you know, but this lost text physically is really difficult to get. So it's not here about AI replacing the historians. It's really a massive collaboration between the computer scientists, the physicists, and the experts in ancient texts. So it's just kind of here AI is augmenting the human expertise, allowing these scholars to do something that was physically impossible before. And that is pretty powerful here.
Yeah, that's really cool. And it makes me think a little bit about, I mean, It'd be really cool to put like together a little engineering core that just goes from like field to field, basically looking for these areas to kind of like break down the kind of bottlenecks. Because I assume once you start looking, they're kind of everywhere, right, in these domains. And, you know, the traditional problem is how do you drag engineers to work on these types of things? But I mean, I would love to. I mean, it's such a cool topic. All right, I'm going to close this up there. That's all the time we have for today, because we're going to move on to this final segment with Suja on the cost of a data breach report. But as always, Kautar, Kush, Volkmar, thanks for joining us. And we'll see you soon on Mixture of Experts.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I'm thrilled to have Suja Viswesan joining us today. She's the Vice President of Security and Runtime Products, and she's joining us for MOE for the very first time. So Suja, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really excited.
Yeah, definitely. So we wanted to have you on the show because we actually covered this cost of a data breach report in 2024. And I understand that you were pretty deeply involved this year in helping the 2025 report get together. Yeah, we'd love to kind of dive into the data, but I think I wanted to kind of start with one number which really stuck out at me, which was that it turns out that 97% of organizations that reported on the study said that they had either experienced an AI-related breach or lacked proper AI access controls. So this is really wild, right? Because in some ways, some of this IP around AI is like some of the most valuable things that companies own and hold on to. And so I'd love to hear a little bit more about that number. Are you shocked by that number? It certainly stood out to me.
Look, it is shocking and also kind of expected, because the challenges that typically an organization have are all like multi-fold increased because of AI. It's like one of my colleagues used to say, it's like COVID. You wanted to have for your vaccines to help with you, but you still have to wash your hands and then keep it clean. So the basic hygiene that are not there get exposed and exploited very much in this AI era. That is why I said it's not surprising, but at the same time, it is surprising that the other number is only 63% of organizations. Actually, 63% of organizations don't have enough AI governance policies in order for them to address this kind of problems.
That's right. And so is that the right way of thinking about it, which is that some of the problem here is coming out of just like companies already don't get the basics right? And then now what we're kind of finding is this age of AI, like it's really almost accelerating those issues in a really big way.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So a breach that took 6 months or so, or even sometimes 2-3 months in order to get there, now, because of AI in people's bad hands, it can just expose all these problems in a much more faster manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we're really seeing this. I mean, I remember when we were talking a few years ago, it was like, oh, well, pretty soon you're going to have AI enhanced attackers, right? And like the space is going to be a lot more dangerous than it used to be in some sense. Do you want to give, you know, I guess our listeners some of the flavor of the kinds of attacks that we're starting to see? Because I think when people hear like, oh, AI enhanced attacks, they still sort of don't have they have a very fuzzy vision of what that looks like. But in practice, what are we talking about? Is it things like phishing? I'm just curious about what it looks like.
I think it's one part of it is phishing, definitely, which took 14 days or something to craft a phishing message. And then we have initial controls and security controls and like, oh, look at the language. Is it the grammar? And all those basic stuff that we used to know is changing. Now it takes in minutes or seconds in order to craft a very, very personalized, diligent phishing attack. So it has upped the game, right? For the attackers, and then for the defenders, they need to be working on different protocols on how to determine this. And the second part of it is that at the end of the day, we do have a lot of data challenges. You talked about initially the IP, the crown jewels of a company are exposed through AI, and proper governance and controls are not in place, they can be easily exploitable. So that is why this becomes two-way prong. And yes, we also have AI on the defender side to help. That is why if you look at the numbers, the cost of data breach is going down because the defense is also upping their game. But at the same time, the offense is also upping their game. So it's like a race, if you will.
Yeah, that's right. When I did want to ask a little bit about, because we talked about this last year, any big trends that stood out to you about how the kind of trajectory of this is evolving? You know, I think it sounds like you just mentioned one of them, which is I guess some good news, which is that like AI defense is starting to mature. And so the end result is these breaches are less expensive. Anything else that you think people should be paying attention to?
Extensive use of AI in security is actually giving a lot of cost savings for the customers, right? We saw in the data breach like about 1.9 million savings because they are able to use AI in order to protect. So that is a big thing, positive side. Yes, it is a scary world. It's always a big. But we are also seeing a lot of positive sides on how you adopt AI in order to defend and increase your protection. The other part is a lot of work in this, especially needle and haystack problem. With AI, you can elevate your security analyst's life because now they are able to spend their time in actually preventing the attacks instead of doing the hard work, labor, that we can now offload to the AI.
Yeah, that's right. And so are you ultimately kind of, are you optimistic? Like, do you feel like next year when we're sitting here talking about cost of a data breach 2026, is the kind of cost, like impact of these breaches going to continue to decline? Like, is basically things becoming more defense dominant over time? Or do you feel like we're kind of bottoming out? Like next year, we're going to see that the numbers are kind of the same as they are this year.
I think the cost will go down, but the volume might go up.
Okay.
Right. In a different way.
So what is that? More breaches, less per breach.
Because of what I said earlier, where you have some existing hygiene issues. So that is why your data security posture for both structured and unstructured, your identity and access, your secret posture, all those encryption posture need to all level up in order for you to reduce the attack surface.
And I'm kind of curious, I mean, again, I only had a quick chance to read this report because it just got released recently, are you finding that there's differences between enterprises? Like, do certain types of enterprises like, oh, wow, the data governance problem is really big there, versus like some other types of enterprises, it's like, oh, well, the security analysts aren't enhanced enough using AI. I'm kind of curious about like almost what the landscape of this looks like on the defense side.
See, the critical infrastructure, critical companies, enterprises, it is important because they already had regulations and everything. For example, financial health, they were all very highly regulated. That is why for them, it becomes really important. So for them, it's a one-step function. For those who weren't, they're not highly regulated, but now it is very critical for their business because of ransomware, because of data breach. If they lose trust with their customers, it's very difficult to build it up. So that is why the non-regulated industry, even though they didn't care before because they were not regulated, now they have to care because of security issues. That is where the difference comes into play for the regulated and the unregulated industries.
Well, I guess maybe one last question for you that I'd be curious about. You know, we have a lot of listeners who are probably reading this report and they might be saying, actually, I don't have an AI governance policy or anything like that. Do you have a recommendation for how people can get started here? Like if they say, okay, this is a real problem, what can I do? What should I be doing tomorrow?
The first thing is look at your data, which is easier said than done. So how is your structured and unstructured? Because I do believe that for structured, we have a very clear regulation and governance and governance policy. The unstructured side, because that is what a lot of your AI is trained on to help increase productivity, that is where we need to look at the lineage. Is your governance and access policy travel along with this unstructured data all the way in? So looking at that helps to prevent some of these problems. I would start with that. Do I have a lineage and a clear accountability when it comes to unstructured data? When they get sharded and then put in a vector database, do I know where it came from and who can have access? Then that will inform the model on how it is going to behave. I think that is where I would start as I'm thinking about the enterprise.
That's great. Well, Suja, thanks for coming on the show, and hopefully we'll have you back next year.
Thank you. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks to all you listeners for joining us. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.